This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. There's jazz down in New Orleans, never mind the hurricane. And in Chicago, folks have long had jazz upon the brain. New York has been a home to jazz, played late into the night. And if you think it's also in St. Louis, well, you're right. And there is jazz in Utah, too, although a different sort. For elsewhere, jazz is music. In Salt Lake, they play a sport. Joining me now on the line to discuss the team currently playing basketball more successfully than all the other teams in the National Basketball Association, with the possible exception of the Orlando Magic, is Salt Lake City Tribune columnist Kurt Cragthorpe. Kurt, welcome to Only a Game.
Nice to join you.
The Utah Jazz began the season by going 12-1. They are currently 13-4. Had anybody predicted this kind of strong start?
No, not at all. It's been a very big and pleasant surprise. This was a team that won exactly half of its games last year, and everyone thought they might slightly improve over that figure, but certainly to be 13-4 is a kind of a shock.
The Jazz have won a lot of games without their best player, all-star forward Andrei Kirilenko. Who stepped in and contributed when the Russian forward went down with an injury?
Probably the best answer to that would be Ronnie Brewer, a rookie from Arkansas, who has stepped in and played well, and also a second-round draft choice, Paul Millsap from Louisiana Tech. Kind of a nice coincidence there. That's the school that Karl Malone came to the Jazz from.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of those young guys have exceeded expectations.
The Jazz selected Deron Williams with the number 3 pick in the 2005 NBA draft. Then their rookie point guard proceeded to have what most people considered a subpar year, at least if you had to compare it to the year number 4 pick Chris Paul had. But nobody's complaining now, right?
Exactly, and that's been an interesting phenomenon. It's almost a statement in the silence in that regard that no one's bringing up the name of Chris Paul, as happened throughout last year. As you can well imagine, that the Jazz management was heavily criticized the better that Chris Paul played as the year went on. It made them look worse, obviously, but your observation is correct that Deron Williams has really matured in the start of his second year, and those comparisons aren't being made much anymore.
Who else has been especially useful in helping Utah to this start?
Well, certainly Carlos Boozer has been probably the primary factor, and he's an interesting story in himself. If you go back to this time last year, he was injured with a hamstring problem, and the cynical response to that was that he was simply unhappy in Utah and was trying to force a trade by not playing, and so there was a lot of criticism and skepticism about him, but he has been absolutely very consistent this year and really the biggest reason the team is playing the way it is.
How does the current team compare stylistically to the great Stockton-Malone teams of the 80s and 90s?
If somehow you could blur the faces and the numbers on the jersey, you would think that it was exactly the same team. Scouts say that Jerry Sloan is running the exact same plays he always has, and they're very similar. There's no question about that.
The Jazz play in a very strong conference. They beat San Antonio on Wednesday but got blown out by the Lakers on Thursday night. Will Utah be able to make it past San Antonio, Dallas, Houston, and L.A. and into the finals?
Well, that's a good question. And obviously the thing that we have no idea about is how they will perform in a playoff series. Basically, very few of these guys have made the playoffs, and it's said to be a different kind of basketball, and obviously a little more pressure in a seven-game series. And so that's the big unknown. Obviously, seeding has a lot to do with that, and if the Jazz at least win the Northwest Division, they're guaranteed at least the number 4 seed, and if they keep playing the way they are, possibly could be seeded higher than that. But certainly there's a lot of variables that we'll be talking about in April.
Kurt, I have read that environmentalists protested on Wednesday night outside the sports venue formerly known as the Delta Center. What was that all about?
It's really been an interesting phenomenon. A hazardous waste depositing company called Energy Solutions has acquired the name rights to the former Delta Center. And I have to say that I greatly underestimated what the backlash would be in that regard. It was kind of ironic in that the reason the company chose to do this proactive advertising by buying the name rights was that their surveys had shown how few people had even heard of their company. Well, apparently more have heard of it than they thought, because there has been quite a negative response to that.
I'm wondering if fans of teams in the Western Conference, at least at this point in the season, are looking at the teams in the Eastern Conference and saying, hey, man, if we can get to the finals, we sweep easy.
You know, I think that has been a consideration, probably even going back the last few years, not just this year. But we do feel out here that the West is much stronger, and that the teams have a tendency to keep each other down in the West, just because it's so tough to get to the finals. So it kind of works both ways. You can be worn out by the time you play that final series, or, like you say, you can have a definite advantage. And I think that people kind of wish that there was a different playoff system, actually, that would reward a team in the West that had a much better record than a counterpart in the East.
Kurt Craigthorpe is a columnist for the Salt Lake City Tribune. He joined me on the line from Salt Lake City. Kurt, thank you very much for speaking with me.
I enjoyed it.
As Wednesday dawned in Boston, pro basketball fans readied themselves for the titanic struggle to determine which NBA colossus would assume first place in the Atlantic Division of the Eastern Conference. Would it be the Boston Celtics, winners of just 5 of their first 13 games, or the New Jersey Nets, losers of 6 games in a row, including a home loss to a team tied for fewest wins in the league, the Charlotte Hornets? At a practice on the afternoon before the big tilt, Celtics coach Doc Rivers acknowledged that even early in the season, the phenomenon of 2 sub-500 teams playing for the division lead was pretty weird.
Let's just throw out the records and let's like pretend that this is the olden days right now. And no, it is bizarre. Right now, our conference or our division, obviously no one's playing great, but I'll take it. You know, anytime they can say you're in first, no matter what your record is, all you can do is what your division is. So we'll take it, but we want to be better, obviously. We want to be a better basketball team. We want to improve. We are improving. But we got to continue to do it, and we got to just be more consistent as a team.
Coach Rivers doesn't believe the hapless state of the Atlantic Division, in which the 5 teams were a combined 21 games under 500, proves that all the good franchises live in other divisions.
I think my first year here, it was like this early on, and everyone made fun of our division. And then by the end, 4 teams got hot. 4 teams out of our division actually made the playoffs, and they turned it around. I think hopefully that'll happen, which means that would include us.
Maybe it will, but just over a dozen games into the season, nobody in the Atlantic Division could legitimately be feeling optimistic. While better teams in the West were sporting records like 12-2 and 10-4, and while the Dallas Mavericks had already put together an 11-game winning streak, neither New Jersey, Boston, Philadelphia, New York, or Toronto had won more than 6 times. Still, Brian Scalabrine, a Celtic who still has friends on the New Jersey team for which he used to play, didn't think anybody on either team would feel sheepish to be playing for first place on a sub-500 team.
I don't think it's an embarrassment about being in first place or not. I think it's more about how you're playing right now and how the team is playing. Obviously, them losing 6 games in a row, they're not playing well. You know, maybe they're not as good as what people think. You know, I mean, they were supposed to be the top 3 team in the Eastern Conference, and they're struggling right now. You know, sometimes it's just like that. So as far as my buddies over there, they are my buddies, but tonight they're not my friends.
Among the Nets who were supposed to help New Jersey bob toward the top of the Eastern Conference, at least according to preseason predictions, are Jason Kidd, Vince Carter, and Richard Jefferson. In the locker room before Wednesday night's game, Jefferson said it wasn't possible to determine exactly why the Nets had been so bad.
No, we have multiple things to blame for our losing streak. Not closing out 4 quarters, not playing well in the first half, not playing well in the first quarter, not defending in the fourth quarter. We pretty much, you know, we're bad teams find different ways to lose, and you know, right now we're a bad team.
But not, as it turned out, as bad as the Celtics on Wednesday night. Though Boston led at the half and built a 15-point cushion during the third quarter, this time around it was the home team that failed to play defense in the fourth quarter. If the Nets look tired early, as they well might have been, having played three times over the previous four nights and having just returned from a West Coast trip during which they couldn't beat anybody, it was the Celtics who seemed heavy-legged and lost at the end of the game. With a chance to tie the score in the closing seconds, Boston couldn't even get off a shot. With their 106-103 triumph, the 6-9 Nets vaulted into first place, a circumstance that did not encourage New Jersey guard Vince Carter to celebrate.
No, not really. I mean, you just know it's up and down, and, you know, you just have to keep plugging away and do our job now because, I mean, it's all the losses that we've had, we still are right there in our division. So, you know, we're thankful, believe it or not, because we're still in a good position here.
At least one more or less neutral observer of this battle for first place agreed with Carter's assessment. Peter May covers basketball for the Boston Globe. He said of Wednesday night's game that it could be the start of a run that would put some distance between the talent-laden Nets and the mediocrity of the rest of the Atlantic Division.
This team has had a history of when they turn it around, they really turn it around. They go on big winning streaks. And they've got a very cushy schedule coming up. A lot of games at home. They've already been out west, too, and lost four out there. So they're going to settle in the lovely confines of the swamps of Jersey and maybe make a run right now. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
Following last night's action, the Boston Celtics fell a full game behind the New Jersey Nets, who now sit atop the frighteningly competitive Atlantic Division. The Nets host their division rivals, the 5-9 Philadelphia 76ers, this evening. So, in the short run at least, Peter May might be right. If you're interested in listening at your leisure to Only a Game, to my weekly commentary, or to longer versions of my conversations with authors, athletes, and experts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, a Busby Berkeley-esque display involving parachutes. But first, at the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver, female athletes will twirl and tango, they will put the biscuit in the basket, and they will even slide face first down a frozen chute at speeds in excess of 70 miles an hour. But women will not be invited to show their skills at the Flying V on Vancouver's ski jump. On Tuesday, the International Olympic Committee rejected women's ski jumping as an Olympic event for the Vancouver Olympics. Joining me on the line from Park City, Utah, is Dee Dee Corradini, president of Women's Ski Jumping USA and former mayor of Salt Lake City. Ms. Corradini, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
And I'm also going to be speaking with ski jumper Jessica Jerome, who's currently ranked fifth in the world in that sport. Ms. Jerome, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Jessica, let's start with you. The decision that kept your sport out of the 2010 Olympics must have been a terrible disappointment.
It was. It was heartbreaking.
Was it a surprise?
6 months ago, if you had asked me 6 months ago, I would have said yes. But recently, we had been hearing only negative things, so we were kind of prepared to expect the worst.
You're just 19 years old. Are you thinking already in terms of 2014?
That's so far away. I don't know. I'm just really hoping that we can change some people's minds at the IOC and get this in 2010, because if we don't, there are going to be lots of girls that are so far into the sport now that aren't going to stick around until 2014.
Ski jumping and the Nordic combined, an event which includes ski jumping, are the only Winter Olympic sports in which women do not participate. Dee Dee, what's the rationale here?
We don't think there is a rationale for having locked women out of the Olympics in ski jumping. We think politics was at play. We feel as though these women are being discriminated against. To allow skier cross in as a new event and not take women's ski jumping, we're not asking to add a new sport or a new discipline. We're just asking to include women in an existing event.
From the figures that I've been able to collect, women's ski jumping has more participants than women's ski cross, the sport to which you alluded and which was added to the roster of sports for Vancouver. Since 1991, all new sports added to the Olympic program must include participation for men and women. Should this rule apply to existing Olympic sports?
We certainly think so. The time has come to allow women to compete fully. They're ready, and particularly in ski jumping. These women have been training since they were 6 years old. Ski jumping has been in the Olympics since 1924, and women have been ski jumping for a long, long time. So its time has come. This is really a very bad decision on their part, in our opinion.
Your facts and figures notwithstanding, the IOC cited the limited number of women and the limited number of countries participating in this sport as the reason for its decision. Is the IOC correct to worry that, like softball and baseball, this sport would be dominated by athletes from a very few countries?
No. If you look at the statistics, we have 120 women competing from 16 countries. And if you look at skier cross, there are 35 athletes from 15 countries. We are way ahead of where skeleton and bobsled were when they were put into the Olympic Games. We are ready. The statistics are there. They're arguing that we haven't had two world championships. Well, by 2010, we will have had one world championship, four junior world championships, and these women are competing in 26 events throughout the year during their season. And we have women from nine different countries are on the podium during their season. So we have plenty of spread.
Ski cross is very similar to snowboard cross, which, of course, drew huge crowds and great big TV ratings at the Torino Games. As much as the Olympic movement exists to promote athletics, it's also a business. Do enough people watch women's ski jump to justify its inclusion in an event as large as the Olympics?
Ski jumping is a huge sport for men in Europe, and what could be more exciting than watching women fly at 50 to 60 miles an hour down a ski jump? It's an extremely exciting, popular sport to watch, and we think people would love to see the women.
Jessica, I assume that you've been talking to other competitors in your sport since the decision came down. What is the mood among them, and what do you guys do next?
Everybody is just so disappointed. I've talked to some of the Canadian girls, I've talked to some of the Norwegian girls, and everybody is just shocked. And we're all trying to pull together and do our own part to try and, you know, figure out what we can do to change the IOC's mind. I know this was supposed to be sort of the last chance, final decision, but they've made exceptions in the past, and we're not giving up. It's not over until it's over, basically.
There is precedent if you look back at some of the other sports, but one of the other issues that the Canadians have raised, and since they're the hosts of Vancouver, it's a key issue, is a legal issue. And according to the athletes who've written a letter to VANOC, it is against the Canadian Charter and the Canadian Human Rights Act to have any government money spent for facilities that exclude women. The athletes in Canada have brought that up, and so that is one area that we're exploring now is the legal avenue.
Jessica, I don't mean to make light of this, but I'm wondering if you or any of your fellow athletes, ski jumpers, have sort of thought, well, gee, maybe it's time to strap on the pads and become a hockey player or a snowboarder or something.
You know, we've actually joked about that. If you can't beat them, join them, right? You know, we're all saying we're going to convert to ski or cross and show everybody up. But, you know, when it comes down to it, all the girls that ski jump internationally on this Continental Cup circuit have been doing it for so long, and it's a passion, and we all love it, and it's fun, and it's what we want to keep doing. And so we're just going to keep trying and pulling for that.
Ski jumper Jessica Jerome, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
And Dee Dee Corradini, president of Women's Ski Jumping USA. Dee Dee, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
In 1483, Leonardo da Vinci designed a parachute, which, when finally tested, nearly crushed a jumper to death with its sheer weight. But skydiving has evolved into a full-blown extreme sport, and today's parachutes are a bit more streamlined. Recently, more than 1,000 skydivers pulled their high-tech chutes over the dusty desert town of Eloy, Arizona, as part of the largest national skydiving championship in history. Arizona Public Radio's Jillian Ferris-Cole was there.
Turkey vultures are usually about the only things flying through the air over Eloy's tumbleweeds and cacti. But on this day, the birds have plenty of company.
We put up 7 planes 4 minutes apart, over 2,000 skydives that take 7 aircraft turning all day long. So it's absolutely beautiful.
Betsy Barnhouse is the manager of Skydive Arizona, host of this year's U.S. Skydiving Championship. What started out 49 years ago as a single-event competition with about 100 divers has now grown into a full-blown spectacle with everything from massage therapy tents to ESPN camera crews. There are now about 1,000 skydivers taking part in 10 events with names like sky surfing, free fall style, and aerial acrobatics. Scott Davidson of Dallas, Texas, explains his event, free flying.
We're in a vertical discipline where we're basically flying head down or in a sit position, literally like sitting in a bar stool, sitting straight up.
It's hard for the earthbound to imagine enjoying a martini while falling at 120 miles per hour, yet every year more and more people try skydiving. Chris Needles, director of the U.S. Parachute Association, says jumpers range from teenagers celebrating their sweet 16s to former U.S. presidents.
When I was working in the White House for President Bush, I just happened to ask him if he would like to make a skydive, and it's almost really in jest. And the next morning, he called me up at probably around 6 o'clock in my hotel room, and it was one of those calls where the secretary or the assistant said, "Can you hold for the president?" You know, and you get that kind of thing at first thing in the morning, it's a bit shocking. So I jumped up, stood at attention, and was talking to former President Bush. And he said, "Chris, I want to make a skydive. Can you come over to my office today?" So I went over there with him. 6 weeks later, we jumped. Made a nice landing right there in Yuma Proving Ground. And it was clear he wanted to do it again.
Needles says that's a sentiment echoed by many skydivers. And it may be the reason this year's national championship is so big. The largest event is called Canopy Formation. It involves at least 4 and sometimes up to several hundred people who drop at the same rate and level. They have 35 seconds to perform a series of choreographed moves that physically connect them to each other, hand to leg, ankle to ankle, and so on. Paul Bertarelli is the captain of a 4-person team from New Jersey called Controlled Descent. He says a lot of groundwork goes into a formation before the team takes it to the air.
We prepare for each dive with what we call a dirt dive, and we walk through the different formations standing up, and then we lay it down on creepers, which are basically little platforms with rollers.
Creepers resemble what mechanics use to slide around under cars, but skydivers use them stomach down to practice formations. Again, Paul Bertarelli.
We work out all the different angles, so we try to duplicate what we'll do in the air on the ground so we know what to expect and we can visualize the dive. Most of the communication is with eye contact. You look across the formation to see if your peace partner or your clone has the grip and you move on to the next one.
A videographer accompanies each team on the way down. Since skydivers look like dots from the ground, judges use the videotapes to score each team. That puts a lot of pressure on the cameraman.
If you're not there, it don't count.
That's Dean Ruzicka, videographer for the team False Religion.
You can get sucked down in the formation and end up crashing into them, which will take them out, and of course you don't get the shot. It's my first year at Nationals, so I'm just trying not to mess up. Not doing too well. We're currently in dead last.
But Ruzicka says he doesn't really care about winning a trophy today. He just wants to keep jumping out of airplanes. For a long time, Ruzicka says he kept his high-flying passion a secret from his family because they thought skydiving was too dangerous. But Ruzicka says moms always find out.
My mom called me on my phone, and someone at the drop zone just picked it up, and they're like, "He's in the air right now." And she's like, "What do you mean he's in the air?" And she had no clue I was skydiving. And of course, that went over very well.
When it's time to take to the air, some teams board pilot Clay Schultz's Twin Otter plane. He's been loading and unloading skydivers all day.
You want them to be able to get out at a point where they can always make it back to the landing area. You don't want them landing out in the middle of, you know, wherever, the desert, the city, wherever the drop zone happens to be.
Schultz says that's enough adrenaline rush for him. He has no desire to jump.
About 3 weeks ago, my boss kind of pushed me and I did it for the first time. I prefer staying in the airplane. It's scary stuff getting out.
For competitor Kim Schaefer of the team Pinky and the Brain, the first jump had a much different effect.
I got on the ground and I said, "I want a parachute for Christmas." And a month later, I was a licensed skydiver.
On land, Schaefer is a fire dancer, stilt walker, and performance artist. She has since become an acrobatic freestylist in the air.
Looks like I'm doing like an aerial ballet act where I keep my toes pointed and I do like gymnastic moves for like the grace of dance.
Today, Schaefer will make at least 4 jumps in her hot pink rhinestone suit. She is very modest about her talent.
I'm actually really new. I have about 615 jumps. Probably sounds like a lot to you, but it's not. To get good at freestyle, it takes a couple thousand jumps. A camera flyer actually has to fly better than me because my speed changes constantly depending on what I'm doing.
But when the green light comes on in the back of the plane, Schaefer stops talking and starts checking her equipment. It's time to jump. It takes less than a minute for 23 people to jump out of the plane. And with style always a consideration, Schaefer does a graceful leap into the cold air, her toes perfectly pointed. Her cameraman does a quick handstand on the jump platform before hurling himself out of the door behind her, 13,000 feet above the stage where they hope to win a medal. For Only a Game, I'm Jillian Ferris Cole in Eloy, Arizona.
You're listening to Only a Game. Among the intriguing emails this week was a list submitted to Only a Game, among other places, by Douglas Abrams, a law professor at the University of Missouri and a veteran coach of youth sports. Veteran, as in 40 years on the sidelines. Mr. Abrams contends that the state of youth sports isn't as grim as much of what is reported in the press would lead people to believe. As evidence for this assertion, he sent Only a Game some examples of admirable behavior by young competitors. Among them is a story of Alaskan Michaela Hutchinson, the 103-pound wrestler who this year became the first girl to win a state championship while competing against boys. What made the story especially noteworthy, according to Professor Abrams, was the response of Aaron Boss, whom Hutchinson beat in the finals. "I don't look at it as losing to a girl," Boss said. "I lost to a wrestler." Back in April, freshman distance runner Sarah Lopez of Hacienda Heights, California, was awarded a medal in a 3,200-meter race when the girl who had crossed the finish line first, Jessica Ida, was disqualified for interfering with Lopez. Certain that their collision had been her fault, Lopez asked the official to reverse his decision. When he wouldn't, Lopez gave Ida her medal. The Roberson, North Carolina High School boys soccer team also caught the attention of Professor Abrams. After they'd apparently beaten conference rival Asheville High, several of the Roberson players pointed out to the official that the alleged winning goal had gone through the side of the net and shouldn't have counted. The official reversed his decision. The game ended in a tie, and John Mitchell, the youngster who'd scored the goal, said, "I'd rather have a tie than win on an unfair call." Admirable, certainly, but short of life-saving, the same can't be said of the achievement of 11 members of the Centralia, Illinois high school football team. While they were working on a community recycling project, a pickup truck slipped off a lift and rolled on to a mechanic. The players lifted the truck off the man who otherwise might have died. One of the players, Travis Patton, dismissed suggestions that he and his teammates were heroes. "If I was in that spot," he said, "someone would have done it for me. And if I'm ever in that spot, I hope there's a high school football team within easy hailing distance." But that's not the point. These stories, and the rest of the ones on the list, certainly do suggest that youth sports are not entirely the province of spoiled children and parents with guns. I'm happy, as I hope you are, that Douglas Abrams brought them to our attention.
Let's rock and roll.
Let's rock and roll.
Do you know?
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com. This is NPR, National...
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, fiddling and diddling on Irish basketball courts. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me from Chicago, where I think he's snowed in. What are you up to out there?
Yes, the Swiss family Only a Game is stuck in the hotel for another night.
It's another big college football weekend, Charlie, so I'm about to bowl you over with my football knowledge. Do you like Florida over Arkansas in today's SEC championship game, Oklahoma over Nebraska in the Big 12, Rutgers over West Virginia in the Big East? I, of course, have the sheet in front of me.
Actually, I'm most intrigued, as anybody with any sense of the history of college football, is by the Oklahoma-Nebraska matchup. This is the 35th anniversary of the game of the century in 1971, the great Johnny Rogers Heisman Trophy winning game, 35-31, perhaps the greatest college game I've ever seen. Oklahoma-Nebraska, back before the rise of the mega conferences, was appointment viewing every Thanksgiving. Now they don't even play on Thanksgiving. For the historical residents, I'll take Nebraska-Oklahoma and USC-UCLA, although I think Oklahoma-Nebraska is going to be a better game.
Though LSU has not yet been invited to the Rose Bowl, fans of that team have purchased over 30,000 tickets to the Pasadena Pigskin Pageant. This is a risky investment, no?
It's a little bit, but it does show you that for all the BCS nonsense and all the let's have a playoff and all the phony conference championship fundraiser games, the Rose Bowl still matters. I mean, the Rose Bowl is still the college football game that matters. An SEC team hasn't gone there since 1946. The idea that 30,000 LSU fans would buy tickets to the Rose Bowl on spec says all you need to know about the draw and the pull and the kind of charisma that event has.
Were you ready for some Thursday night football?
I sort of was, because it was interesting. There was a boomlet building about the Baltimore Ravens. You know, people talked about the AFC clearly being superior to the NFC, and the best team in the AFC being San Diego or perhaps Denver or even perhaps New England Patriots. Baltimore over the last couple of weeks has gotten a lot of love from people watching the NFL, especially for their defense and for the revival of Steve McNair. Cincinnati has put themselves back into the position where they have a vague chance at the playoffs again. Carson Palmer, their quarterback, is a medical miracle. And so this put a little dent in the Baltimore bandwagon.
There had been a lot of talk coming this week from various members of the New York Giants football team, ranging from guarantees that the team would beat Dallas tomorrow to Michael Strahan criticizing teammate Plaxico Burress for not trying hard enough. Did Tom Coughlin tell everyone to shut up, or did the Giants equipment manager find all the team muzzles?
This particular moment of chaos and ill feeling was foreordained as soon as the New York Giants hired Tom Coughlin. He's a silly, ridiculous disciplinarian who has a shelf life with the team for a couple of years, and at which point the teams get so distracted and so unnerved by his nutty rules that they either start taking it out of themselves or taking it out on him. And now I think we're dealing with a kind of mass outbreak of passive-aggressive behavior where they're taking it out on him by taking it out on themselves.
Meanwhile, the Super Bowl champion or defending Super Bowl champion Pittsburgh Steelers are 4-7, so was that a dynasty over before it began?
Well, it was sort of a dynasty that never quite got there, and I think that there was a very real possibility that the Super Bowl win was the closing of the window rather than the opening of it. Bill Cowher has done all he can losing players every year to free agency. They won it last year. He's openly talking about moving to North Carolina. He was rumored to take the North Carolina State job. He's been talking about maybe taking a year off and not coaching anywhere. So what I think is what happened is that the Super Bowl win was the capstone of the Cowher era rather than the beginning of another one.
An Associated Press poll this week surveyed about 20% of the people eligible to vote in the Hall of Fame election, and 1 in 4 plans to approve Mark McGwire's induction into the Baseball Hall of Fame. A lot of them cite McGwire's testimony during congressional hearings in March of 2005. Legitimate reasoning?
I don't know. I mean, Halls of Fame voting, in particular Baseball Hall of Fame voting, make intelligent people act very stupidly. As I've said often, put everybody in, make it a very large museum, perhaps the size of an airplane hangar, and let everybody wander through. Look, he did not conduct himself well before the kangaroo spotlights-only congressional committee. He could have handled himself better. He did not put on the abject forelock tugging dumb show for the National Baseball Writers that they wanted to condescend to vote for him for the Hall of Fame. Considering I don't consider any of these reasons legitimate, I suppose this is as legitimate as any of them.
The Red Sox are apparently close to signing Japanese pitcher Daisuke Matsuzaka to a contract, and on Thursday they announced the signing of a left-hander, Hideki Okajima. What do they expect, that Okajima will be a settling influence on Manny Ramirez?
Well, I don't think they're going to have to worry about settling Manny Ramirez if Curt Schilling, conscience of the nation, has his way, who has apparently traded him out of town already. It must be true. I'll tell you what, the Red Sox are going to sell a lot of jerseys to a lot of people we don't know yet. There are no foreigners, Bill. There are only pitchers we haven't signed.
Justin Gatlin, the runner who tested positive for testosterone this year, was subsequently banned from track and field competition for 8 years, but he worked out with the Houston Texans this week. Is the team enamored of his speed, his experience playing high school football, all the testosterone he seems to be carrying around, or all of the above?
I think the team is enamored of the fact that they don't have any wide receivers and their quarterback is once again getting killed. This is a throwback, of course, to the golden days where it was the career path was to win your Olympic gold medal and then become an NFL sprinter. It happened with most notably Bob Hayes, but mm-hmm. with a bunch of other folks. But now, given the amount of money that's out there in the track and field circuit, you don't see that much anymore.
Allen Iverson is once again in a heap of trouble. The Sixers plan on fining him, this time for missing the team bowling event on Wednesday. When is this guy going to clean up his act?
I have no idea, but given the fact that he wound up going to jail for something that happened in a bowling alley in high school, maybe he just stays out of bowling alleys.
And finally, Charlie, on Tuesday, Sheffield Hallam University Center for Sports Exercise Sciences published a study that proves English footballer Wayne Rooney generates enough energy during a match to boil water for 16 cups of tea. Didn't you think it would be more than that?
There's no question that Wayne Rooney has in the past boiled over. So I suspect that depending on the size of the teapot, I think you're probably right. I think there probably is more energy there.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His most recent book, Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything, has generated enough power to brew several gallons of hot cocoa at least, and he joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Have a cup of tea. Have a cup of tea. Have a cup of tea. For Christ's sake, have a cup of tea.
When Russ Bradford was an assistant basketball coach at the University of Texas at El Paso and later at New Mexico State University, he lived with a secret. Actually, two secrets. He loved to read and write, and he was passionate about the fiddle. As Ireland seemed a satisfactory place to pursue both the writing and the fiddle playing, Russ Bradford decided to relocate. To make a living while he was there, Bradford determined that he would continue to coach basketball, and therein lies the tale titled Paddy on the Hardwood, A Journey in Irish Hoops, a book Mr. Bradford hadn't necessarily intended to write. Russ Bradford joins me now from KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Russ, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. It's good to be here.
How did you even know that there was professional basketball in Ireland?
Well, I'd gone over there on holiday in 2001, and just by chance, I met the Olympic coach, and I was having a wonderful time on vacation. At the time, Bill, I didn't realize it. Just because I was having a wonderful time on vacation did not necessarily mean it would be a good place to get a job. I think if we all did that, you'd be a bartender in Daytona Beach now, and I'd be on Padre Island working in a surf shop. But I had such a great time, I asked the Olympic coach, a man at the time, the man's name was Bill Dooley, who was the Olympic coach at the time, and he had said, there are a couple teams that pay, but he tried to talk me out of it and told me it would be a dead end and it would be too frustrating. And I was having such a good time on vacation, I just didn't believe him.
How did the game you discovered in Tralee, County Kerry, differ from the game that had employed you as an assistant coach, really at the top level of college basketball here in the States?
Well, at UTEP and New Mexico State, the commitment by both the administration and the fans and the media, but especially by the players, would have been much different than the commitment of the players in Tralee. You know, what I found with the Irish players is that if they had a broken nose or a bent finger or, blood running down their eye, that was fine. They would continue to play through that. But they might miss practice because of their cousin's christening or their office work party. They would miss practice for any possible excuse. But once they were committed and involved and in the fight, they were extremely, extremely tough guys.
To what extent were the teams in the league in Ireland dependent for their success on players from the U.S.?
Well, every team in Ireland is allowed to import two American players. And that's sort of the standard rule for all European teams. They get two imports. It doesn't have to be an American, but you're allowed two guys that don't have Irish passports. And so in Ireland, what you're going to get, because the money is so little, it was maybe $250 or $300 a week, what you're going to get is either a player on the way up or a player on the way down. But I have to add there, Bill, that what you would get also for an imported coach would be a coach on the way up, or like me, maybe a coach on the way down also.
Yeah, I was going to wonder about that. I mean, two assistant jobs at fairly high-profile universities. Any temptation after Ireland to get back into the rat race of college basketball?
Bill, I think about it all the time. I'm like the alcoholic that keeps walking past the pub. You know, I think about college basketball a lot, and it's really the only thing I know how to do to make money. It certainly won't be in the book business, I'm afraid. But that was part of what caught me, the irony that caught me and Patty on the hardwood, was I thought that because I'd worked for Don Haskins and Lou Henson, that this would be easy, that I would just go over there and clean up and sweep through the Irish Super League and it wouldn't be much effort. And most importantly, that I wouldn't get emotionally involved, that I could keep my distance and just do it as a job and not let it swallow me up like it had in my 14 years in Division I basketball.
Well, I understand that one of the reasons you didn't want to be swallowed up by basketball in Ireland was you wanted to go to pubs as often as possible to hear great Irish music and learn to play the stuff on the fiddle and, of course, take fiddle lessons yourself. And you've got your fiddle with you. Is that right?
That's right. And I was self-taught and kind of a hack player. I'm an advanced hack now. But part of the charm of Ireland to me was I thought this will be the chance for me to take my first private fiddle lessons. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of stumbled on a reclusive, nearly a hermit, an old County Kerry fiddle player named Paddy Jones, and he became my teacher.
Well, we better hear something about what Mr. Jones taught you to do.
Well, I think maybe if I can do it now, I'll play a slide from County Kerry, a typical...
That was just spectacular, and I'm sure Patty would be proud.
Well, that's one of Patty's tunes that he taught me. It's and that style, that's the slide, which is in 12/8 time, is peculiar to County Kerry, where I was living.
In your first season coaching in Tralee, your team came in dead last. Everything that could go wrong went wrong. And in your second season, the Tigers won everything, national champs. Would there have been a book if they hadn't done that?
Well, I thought for a long time, for a few months, I thought, I'll try and make a book out of our last place season, because Kellogg's Frosted Flakes was our sponsor, the Frosties. Frosties are what the Irish call Frosted Flakes.
Mm-hmm.
We were the Frosties Tigers, and Kellogg's dumped us, and it looked like we had no team. But, you know, Bill, in a lot of ways, they say, somebody who's a smart person said that history is written by the winners and literature is written by the losers. And we were definitely the losers, and I think that's why most of the book focuses on our losing season. I think it's less self-congratulatory for one thing, but I think it made for a better story, and the tragedy, but also the irony of, you know, as the team got worse and worse and worse, and we started losing more and more, and we were in a tailspin, and we couldn't get out of it. But the irony was that I started liking my players better then.
Russ, you write about how coaching the Tigers reminded you of what you had loved about basketball. Why did you need reminding?
Well, my story is not unusual, I don't think. I was a burned-out college coach. I think a lot of college coaches burn out and just keep doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. And they're not as effective, or they make mistakes, or they just don't do as good a job or don't spend as much time. I burned out, and I'm very much a type A, hyper, hard-driven person. But in America, I think it's safe to say that basketball is completely overemphasized. When we get 10 pages of color pictures in the sports section, and we have television stations that are devoted completely to sports. In Ireland, basketball was really in the place that it ought to be in society. It was sort of very far down. The players did it because they loved basketball. The small amount of fans who came did it because they loved it. And I wound up doing it because I liked the game, not because of the money or the prestige or the glamour or the chance to be a head Division I coach somewhere else. And so in a way, it brought back the purity to me. I think the reason that most – I don't want to speak for other coaches, but I would imagine that if you asked Jim Calhoun at UConn or the Boston College coach why they got into coaching basketball, it would not be the same reason as why they continue to coach.
Russ Bradford is the author of Paddy on the Hardwood, A Journey in Irish Hoops, published by University of New Mexico Press. He joined me from KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Russ, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thank you a lot.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Elias Feldman and from John Cohn at KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Paddy on the Hardwood, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Paddy on the Hardwood author Russ Bradford, who recalls when one of his players dispensed advice that was, at the same time, monetary and mixological.
He says, well, if you don't drink to get drunk, you're wasting your money.
Happily, Coach Bradford continued to pace himself, and his team won a championship. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at DigitalLearning.MacFound.org. This is NPR.